Hello and welcome to the Badger Talks podcast, the podcast that shares interviews with experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison community about their work, research, and a little bit about what they're like as people, too. I'm your host, Buzz Kemper. Today, we'll be talking about engineering against cancer, smarter tools for safer surgeries. And I'm happy to have as my guest, Daniel van der Weide, Granger Institute for Engineering Professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dan, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me today. I'm really interested to find out how your research is impacting people's health and lives.
My pleasure to be here.
So you're best known for what's called terahertz generation, and I want to get into how this relates to cancer research and the tools that we use to research, diagnose, and help cure cancers. But just can you give us a broad overview of what is terahertz generation? We all know what radio waves are, and we know AM radio and FM radio, and there are frequencies to everything, including the colors we see. What is terahertz generation?
Well, I got my start in a laboratory at Stanford University that was really centered on electronics as optics or optics as electronics. In other words, viewing things that traditionally were optical with focusing waves and, you know, microscopy and lasers and that sort of thing, and viewing those principles as they are properly viewed as electromagnetics in general. Mm-hmm. So radio on the very low end of the electromagnetic spectrum, or visible light on the very shortwave end of the electromagnetic spectrum, spans an incredibly wide range of frequencies or wavelengths. Mm-hmm. And yet optics and electronics, while they share electromagnetic spectrum, they don't necessarily have too many things in common. We generally denominate frequencies in terms of, you know, multiples of 1,000 hertz, mm-hmm. hertz cycles per second. So megahertz, where many of the radio stations are located, basically FM radio 88 to 108 megahertz, mm-hmm. is a million hertz, 10 to the sixth. Mm-hmm. Gigahertz, your microwave oven operates at 2.45 gigahertz. That's, again, a factor of 10 to the third higher, so billions of hertz.
Right.
It's also where all your cell phones operate.
Okay.
And many radars and that sort of thing. And then moving on, you know, another factor of 10 to the three from gigahertz to terahertz,
yeah,
puts you in a regime that has thus far been largely off limits to both optics and electronics. I mean, it's too fast for electronics, and it's too slow for optics.
Okay.
All right.
Now, what are optics measured in once we go beyond terahertz?
Well, that's a good question. We don't often denominate optics in terms of petahertz, because okay, it just gets crazy.
Okay.
People talk about colors, mm-hmm. or wavelengths. So green, for example, the sort of middle of the visible spectrum is around 530 nanometers. So half a micron of light is the wavelength that appears green to our eyes.
Okay.
And we, our eyes, we can see down to around 800 nanometers, which is really, really deep red.
Okay.
And maybe 400 nanometers is ultraviolet, very, you know, basically beyond,
right,
our visible spectrum. And just like you have a hearing spectrum, which, you know, ideally is 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, although,
right,
for many of us, unfortunately, we're not hearing the 20 kilohertz anymore.
So to clarify, that's interesting to me. So once we get beyond terahertz, once we get into the visible spectrum, we're no longer measuring cycles per second. We're now measuring the distance between the waves when we say nanometers. Am I correct?
Yes. And then, you know, that's really just a matter of convenience,
okay,
as well as practicality.
Right.
So you're actually bringing up a really good point, which is, why do we measure some things with some units and not other things.
Right.
You know,
right.
Why do we don't measure houses in miles?
Right.
We use feet.
Yeah.
We don't measure football fields in terms of inches generally. We talk about yards, right? Yeah. So we have units that are appropriate to the scale of what we're attempting to measure.
Okay.
And just briefly, in optics, you have generally many, many wavelengths, in fact, generally thousands of wavelengths per diameter of the lens, for example. Mm-hmm. So objects in the optical space are generally many, many wavelengths, in fact, hundreds or thousands of wavelengths in extent. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make sense to talk about them in the time domain necessarily. There haven't been that many instruments to measure optical frequencies in the time domain anyway. So if you can't measure it in the time domain, why would you denominate it in that?
Okay.
So you can measure wavelengths, and that's why we use those.
Okay, that makes sense. So in your research going into the terahertz realm, that has had, I imagine, a number of practical consequences, outcomes, but one of which is that it has proven to be valuable in cancer research, or at least in developing tools for cancer research. Can you unpack that a little bit? How does the terahertz research lead to research advances in cancers?
Well, I'd say both directly, but probably more importantly, indirectly. So directly speaking, I've always had an interest in, and I'm not alone in this, okay, mm-hmm. but I've always had an interest in, can these new wavelengths that are much, much shorter than conventional radio wavelengths, but still not visible, mm-hmm. can they reveal contrast mechanisms, for example, in skin or organs that could reveal cancer versus healthy tissue, and do so at a length scale that would be interesting for surgical applications? Turns out that generating and detecting terahertz is still not that easy to do.
Okay.
And so the principles behind this, these contrast mechanisms, however, are really the core of what interests me in terms of applying electrical engineering to either cancer detection, diagnostics, or treatment, therapeutics.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked in both spaces, and I want to emphasize that this has all been highly collaborative, especially with physicians and practitioners. So it's not a one-man show by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, these things rarely are. So your electrical engineering work and your work in terahertz leads to cancer research benefits in the sense that we can, if I'm understanding this correctly, we can bounce these terahertz frequencies off of human tissue and determine its health. Am I correct?
Well, that's a very general concept, and
that's where I'm at right now. Very general.
I would qualify the bouncing or the reflection, if you will, mm-hmm. Which in some sense could be viewed as spectroscopy. We do spectroscopy every day when we look at colors that are reflected off of walls, and it's illuminated with white light, but only certain colors are reflected. Mm-hmm. This kind of spectroscopy, whether it's in reflection or transmission, has always been of very central interest to me, because there's a lot to unpack in that field. Terahertz is one portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, but the principles of using these electromagnetic fields or waves, and by the way, field is a more general concept than a wave. A wave is a traveling field.
Right.
The fields need not travel. They could be bound to a source without necessarily traveling.
Okay.
So I just want to make that slight distinction. But the use of electromagnetic fields and or waves in the interaction with human tissue for the purposes of diagnostics and therapeutics is something that is of growing importance and of growing interest over the last couple of decades. And I have many colleagues in my department and university wide who have similar interests to mine, but are working in their own niche fields. And so the concepts of using this kind of energy, which is not ionizing, not going to damage your DNA, for example, mm-hmm. but simply gently exciting tissue, looking for how that tissue responds, mm-hmm. Lets us do a very important kind of diagnostics without having to, for example, introduce exogenous contrast agents. What do I mean by exogenous? I mean, yeah. outside the body.
Right.
You know, okay. so a fluorescent dye, for example, mm-hmm. or some contrast agent that, you know, a pathologist might use to reveal the presence of cancer in a tissue sample, that process, while well-established, also alters the tissue irreversibly. So the tissue mm-hmm. then can't be subsequently used for testing against potential immunotherapeutics, for example. Okay. And by the way, we have a local, more than a startup in the Madison area called Eliphas, which is working hard, and I'm working with them, to establish means of using immunotherapeutic response in freshly excised tumor tissue or tissue samples in order to determine whether an immunotherapeutic might be applicable or useful for a particular patient. Okay. So there's the manifold opportunities to interrogate tissue without staining it so that you can query it without affecting it and without killing it.
Okay. So then that tissue would then be in good enough shape that you could then use other testing methods on it. It's not done now.
Correct. Okay. Think of a, you know, we use tissue every day in something we call cooking.
Yes, right.
You know, many of us will, use animal products, meat, and cook it, and have a burger or whatever, even an egg. You know, we fry an egg. That's an irreversible transformation of its proteins. Yes, there's indeed. No going back.
Yeah, you're right. You can't
So you're transforming it, right? And so you can't – so that's – you know, I think of that not only in the context of that irreversible transformation, but also, like, think of sushi. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have a sushi roll, it's only good when it's freshly made.
Right.
If it's been sitting there for a couple of hours, you can tell.
Yeah.
So think of human tissue as very much the same way. If it's not fully fresh, it's not as healthy and representative as it might otherwise be if it were situated in the body. Okay. So this is a really important and it's a very simple principle, but I'm not sure it gets all the airplay that it needs. In order to get the most accurate diagnosis, you really want to be and not have to use contrast agents. You really want to have that tissue as fresh, healthy, connected to, you know, its blood supply and its mm-hmm. nutrient supply as possible. Mm-hmm. Anything less than that, as the tissue is dying off, it's irreversibly transformed into something that you can't necessarily diagnose. Mm-hmm. So I'm articulating these principles because we have found, and others have found, that there are contrast mechanisms, ways of seeing contrast, black or white, or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. That are not visible but are accessible to the terahertz or microwave regime of the electromagnetic spectrum that allow us to determine and distinguish between healthy tissue and diseased tissue.
Right. That makes perfect sense. Where are we at in the progress of actually utilizing these spectroscopy methodologies with terahertz generation? Is it still in kind of a theoretical stage? Is there a machine actually built that does this? Where are we at along the spectrum of theory to practical use?
That question could occupy the rest of the day.
You've opened a
very broad range of inquiry here.
Okay.
I'd like to respond in terms of some of the companies that I've had a hand in starting and mm-hmm. that have become successful and have had a hand in treating thousands and thousands of patients, mm-hmm. Because then I can give you specific examples of these.
Great.
The first one would be New Wave Medical, which Fred Lee, physician and radiologist here at UW-Madison, and I co-founded many years ago in sort of the 2003 timeframe. It's in the mists of time. So we got started talking and collaborating. We were neighbors and had kids who'd play together. And I would just point out that without a practitioner, a physician, someone working with patients and understanding the day-to-day problems, it's not easy to postulate a successful application of electrical engineering to a practical patient need. So I want to make absolutely sure that we're giving all the credit to the medical practitioners and the medical minds who are dealing with the actual problems. We as engineers often like to think that we have a solution. That solution sometimes just gets thrown over the wall saying, well, here it is, you know, put it to use. And there's no involvement in the patient treatment process. So just a little bit of the background story. Fred articulated needs for doing ablation of cancerous tissue using percutaneous techniques. In other words, very small needles that wouldn't involve open surgery, which is kind of the gold standard for resecting cancer, but isn't always patients aren't always candidates for that kind of surgery. You might have a patient with a liver tumor that is not a that the patient may not be a candidate for a transplant. Okay. Well, what are you going to do to extend that patient's life? You going to just let the tumor grow and the patient dies too soon? Right. Is there a way you can treat it without drugs or chemotherapy or in combination?
Yeah. And does ablation mean treatment?
Ablation is a means of essentially killing or destroying tissue.
Right.
Okay. And sometimes that's done just in situ, in other words, without resecting it, but just essentially depositing energy or maybe a chemical into the diseased tissue and killing it.
Okay.
While doing minimum harm to surrounding healthy tissue.
Okay, yeah. Unlike something like chemotherapy, which is a little more of a shotgun approach.
Generally, chemotherapy is like you're getting hosed down with radiation.
Right.
And, you know, the body has to basically come back from the dead.
Yes.
Having the ability to focus this treatment is very important. Very important are margins, okay? In other words, there's always a margin, which is not entirely clear to the physician, between the diseased tissue and the surrounding healthy tissue.
Right.
Obviously, you want to have negative margins. You don't want any margin that still has cancer.
Right.
But you don't want to kill or remove or destroy any healthy tissue more than you have to.
Right.
That's the Hippocratic Oath.
Yes.
First, do no harm.
Exactly.
So that's always been the hallmark here of what we've been trying to do, which is to precisely dose the energy so that the diseased tissue is destroyed or ablated, but no more healthy tissue than necessary is destroyed.
Does the terahertz therapy approach, is that more assisting in identifying the cancerous region, or is it used also in terms of the actual ablation or treatment?
Well, that's a very astute question because, as I alluded to earlier, and I want to broaden this concept from terahertz down to, you know, the microwave regime as well, because that's actually a much more practical regime for us to be working in in terms of, you know, generating the kinds of powers that you need to actually do this ablation. Generating microwave power is far less expensive and far more practical than generating terahertz power.
One would think.
It generally gets harder and more expensive as you go higher in frequency. So I just want to set that principle. Well, in any case, the principles of diagnostics and therapeutics in this space are very closely linked, compatible, and we exploit them almost simultaneously. Diagnostics, of course, involves just sort of gentle testing of the tissue without the intent to transform it or hurt it or heat it in any way, mm-hmm. because we just want to do spectroscopy. We want to look at the tissue with new eyes mm-hmm. and see what we see there and make a determination, is there healthy tissue or diseased tissue, right. without actually affecting the tissue. Mm-hmm. So that's the diagnostic realm. And for example, I'm doing projects with Elephas right now on that question.
Okay.
We've also, and I'll speak to another company that Fred and I started called Elucent Medical that uses electromagnetic fields for localizing tumors for subsequent surgery, and especially in breast and lung. Mm-hmm. But let's put that on hold for the moment. For diagnosis, we can look for contrast mechanisms between healthy and diseased tissue. For treatment, we can exploit those contrast mechanisms to preferentially heat the and ablate the diseased tissue over the surrounding healthy tissue. So because of the contrast mechanisms, mm-hmm. you know, by rough analogy, diseased tissue might look darker or denser than healthy tissue.
Right.
And we can see that with our tools. If we can see it that way, we can treat it that way.
Yeah.
You know, just like a dark surface absorbs sunlight more effectively and gets warmer mm-hmm. than a light surface.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a similar principle.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And that, to me, that's one of the biggest areas of cancer treatment that has needed attention is how to better target the diseased areas and not just do this go squirrel hunting with a cannon kind of thing. So, okay.
Well, it's so true, but it's also being developed in a very complex environment mm-hmm. of technology, patient care, payers, hospital administration, traditions, different practitioners and subspecialties, and a bit of a hierarchy about who actually gets to treat the patient first. There's all kinds of complexities to this that have to be respected. Mm-hmm. You can't simply march into a hospital with the next best tool and say, everybody drop what you're doing and use my new invention.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
Right. Of course.
It simply doesn't.
Right. Yeah. Nor should it.
But I think there are good reasons for you know, being cautious.
Right. When you were working with Terahertz Generation, doing your research, were you thinking about its implications in terms of cancer diagnostics and treatments, or were you just developing a tool that you thought might have a number? Did you have a goal in mind? I'm wondering what was the thought process in that area?
Another really penetrating question. I would say some of my earliest memories of working with microwave instrumentation, something called a vector network analyzer, which is costs about as much as a house. And I was fortunate enough, even as an undergraduate at the University of Iowa, to have access to one of these things to make some measurements. And I noted that the presence of my thumb on one of the cables actually changed dramatically the instrument's reading. And so I got a sense of, wow, there's an interaction here between my hand and this instrument.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. And I that experience really stuck with me. Then subsequently in my postdoctoral work in Stuttgart, Germany, I was very fortunate to work with Fritz Keilmann, who was my most immediate advisor. And he was a very multidisciplinary mind who had lots of interest in biological applications of physics. Mm-hmm. And even though that wasn't the world in which we were working at the time, it was solid-state physics, he subsequently did move to another institute that was doing biophysics. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of got the permission to think in terms of more broadly about how physics could be applied to human health and biology. And that enabled me to start thinking more broadly about the applications of some of the electronic techniques that that I was working on, which were really dedicated to semiconductors and devices and transistor-like things, and broadening that to human health.
Oh, this, yeah. I would so like to dive into some of that, but we don't want to go too overly long. I do want to ask you, when you're dealing with electrical engineering, you're dealing with physics. Is it all classical physics, or is there? Do you get into the quantum realm?
Well, it's another question that could occupy us all day.
Sorry, I keep doing this to you.
I mean, there are, of course, quantum mechanical effects that we observe every day, for example, in lasers.
Right.
And right now, nobody can be ignorant of all the buzz around quantum computing, which is a new means of doing computation that doesn't involve classical 1-0 bits,
right?
And there are many groups, particularly in physics here at the University of Wisconsin, that are pursuing different types of quantum computing and qubits.
Yeah.
Our work has touched on some of that, especially in the realm of exciting artificial atoms. Mm-hmm. In other words, quantum mechanically dominated transistors that and exciting them with terahertz light to essentially do scale model atomic and molecular spectroscopy.
Right. Okay.
And that could open a whole new podcast, but you know, I've long had an interest in, can you build scale models of physical things that are otherwise too small to see?
Yeah.
And can you explore their physics in analogous ways? Mm-hmm. We all like analogs when we're working in physics. We build scale models so that we can more easily make measurements and understand things.
Yeah.
And so there is a whole world of scale model atoms and molecules that would have to be excited with and probed and with wavelengths that are commensurate with their energy levels.
Right.
And that's where terahertz would come in.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to wrap up, but I do want to ask two more questions. One is there anything that you would like to say about terahertz generation or its cancer research or diagnostics? Anything you'd like to say that I just haven't asked the right question to elicit?
Well, I'd like to make it clear that this is an extremely multidisciplinary effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd also like to point out that research in this area is very important, no question.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a significant gap between getting research results that might be reproducible and publishable,
mm-hmm.
which is what many of us do in the academic labs on campus here and elsewhere, and translating any of those ideas or results to clinical practice.
Yeah.
All right. That I can't overemphasize how, you know, a one and done, and I don't mean to demean it, but just, you know, you don't have to make a result reproducible thousands of times in order to publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessary. It's not required.
Right.
However, if you translate that to the clinic and it fails one out of 1,000 times,
that's actually
somewhat unacceptable.
Yeah, that's right? A problem.
That you don't want to be that patient number 1,000 in which it didn't work,
right?
So there's a massive inversion between what is counted as success in the academic lab and what actually gets translated into something that not only extends patients' lives, but actually can become a profitable enterprise, which the two need to kind of go together.
Yeah.
And I think that distinction and that translation is one of the most exciting, challenging aspects of what we're doing here, not only in the work that I participated in, but all across campus.
Yeah.
This is something that I think is gaining enormous attention in the last several years. The campus, I think, has kind of grown out of maybe a more traditional ivory tower approach where we just, you know, throw the results over the wall into one that's being very entrepreneurial and applying a lot of the laboratory results to the potential to commercialize and get these results into the clinic.
Yeah.
I'm very encouraged by what's been going on campus-wide.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that's a great point about, yeah, that huge gap between the theoretical and the practical. It needs big bridges built. And
a support mechanism.
And a support mechanism.
You know, that doesn't happen for free.
Right.
You know, there have to be lots of, you know, governmental support, campus-wide administrative support, and funding, whether that comes through venture capital or grants or any combination of those, that's all part of that translation process. Right. And it needs to be bundled together. If you're missing any one piece, it doesn't work.
Right. Yeah. You need all the tools in the box. The last thing I'd like to ask you, Dan, is when you're not engaged in this heavy research and practical work, do you have hobbies, sports? What do you do when you're outside the lab?
I ride my bike.
Oh.
I'm a enthusiastic participant in the Madison area cycling scene and in general endurance athletics.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's a fantastic place to live and to ride a bike, as I think most people around here know. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we're very fortunate to have the landscape and the roads and the infrastructure here in Madison to support that kind of outdoor activity.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That's, yeah, my summers are rock climbing, bicycling, and doing some kayaking.
And we also go see a lot of live music.
Terrific. Well, good for you. That's every musician in the area thanks you for that. Yeah, us too. And
they know who we are. Yeah. We're often in the front row.
That's
cheering
terrific.
Them on,
do you have a favorite venue?
There's lots. You know, we go to the Sylvie when there are larger acts in town. Baroque is a great place.
Yeah, been there. I've actually performed at the Baroque.
And we just have a lot of fun seeing local musicians playing. You know, I know Mama Dig Downs is going to be playing pretty soon.
Terrific.
Like to see people like that and, you know, horn bands.
We've recorded Mama Dig Downs. Yeah, that's terrific. Nice. Very good. Yeah, that New
Orleans. So it's, I mean, Madison has a really burgeoning music scene.
Yeah.
And Rare Element is another band that we really like following.
Yeah,
All those guys are great.
Terrific.
So yeah, we really enjoy seeing the variety of music venues and musicians and acts that come through this area.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's such a great scene, and I feel like we have just an embarrassment of riches. There are cities much larger than ours that can barely support an orchestra. We have two of them. You know, I feel like we are really lucky, and this studio is very fortunate to be involved with most of these.
Well, in the Overture Center.
Yeah. We're there a lot.
The organist, you know.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I've recorded him many times. He's a good friend, actually.
There's just so much. It is an embarrassment of riches here.
It is.
And it's way outsized for the population.
Yeah.
And people who don't appreciate that really need to get out
and
support local music.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Dan, what a treat. Thank you so much. This has been very clarifying. I had no idea that this world existed. And so thank you for your work and your research, and thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Daniel Vanderweide, Granger Institute for Engineering Professor at UW-Madison. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you.
The Badger Talks podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Our engineer is Maggie Shays. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.